Okay, let's start with our little prayer then, John and darling.
Okay.
I wish I could see all of you. I can't. What can we do? Okay, John, do you want to do the prayer? Yes, here we go. So we think, just to think the right way, let's think. We're going to listen together, including me, to these teachings of the Buddha about how we can loosen the grip of ego grasping by realizing, understanding dependent arising by realizing emptiness. And why do you want to do that? So we can stop suffering so that we can then be of benefit to others. This is the idea. So we're going to listen to these teachings for that reason. Sangye chodan soke chognam la janto bari jagni chapsuchi dagi chanyen gi personam ki drora pente sangye drupa shog sangye chodan soke chognam la janto bari jagni chapsuchi dagi chanyen gi personam ki drora pente sangye drupa shog sangye chodan soke chognam la janto bari jagni chapsuchi dagi chanyen gi personam ki drora pente sangye Drupa Shog. Okay, that's it. Oh, what a pity I can't ask you all. I wish you could all just swap the chained windows. We can't do that. Okay. Okay, then. Good enough. Let's talk. So what else I can do? Share, no. Mute, no. Zoom, no. Nothing I can do. Gallery, that's it. Switch to, that's it. Gallery, that's all I can do. Six of you only. What a great pity. Okay. So we have to continue. So what we've been doing so far is looking at how everything in the whole Buddhist, you know, this lam rim packaging, this marvelous packaging of all the Buddhist teachings, from the perspective of the capacity of the disciple to internalize the information, which of course is exactly how every body of knowledge is presented. And, we're expert at that in our culture. We know how to learn things. We start at the beginning, we go to the middle, and we go to the advanced, and then we graduate. Well, that's exactly what the lam rim is. So in exactly the same way, if you, you know, you don't know, let's say you know you want to become a physicist. You want to emulate Einstein, and you maybe you're 10. And you decide you're going to learn to emulate Einstein. Well, you know, you just don't leap into physics. You've got to start with 1 + 1 = 2. And so you know, and this is the point, you know everything you're learning from there onwards is leading you to Einstein's knowledge, is leading you to physics. Everything is preparing your mind, priming your mind, giving you the information that prepares you to get to the level of understanding physics. And this is it's logical. Everything is like this. You know, you want to study a 7-year course and then you end up graduating as some kind of, you know, medical person. Everything is geared. It sort of goes without saying. But our biggest problem when it comes to spiritual path, you know, especially if we're Buddhists, you hear karma, then you hear another thing, you hear about emptiness, then you hear about impermanence, then you hear about compassion, and they seem to be like a series of individual, disconnected pop-up teachings. And we never see the relationship, you know, to each other. This is our biggest problem. So we can study in the centers for 27 years, and all we just do, we think we're starting another little course in Buddhism. What's it got to do with karma? I don't know. What's it got to do with emptiness? I don't know. And this is our biggest problem. That's why we give up, you know. We don't know the relationship between each of the topics. And it's fairly logical. If it's a coherent body of knowledge, it needs to be like that. But we don't think of spiritual teachings like that. We don't think of it as a coherent body of knowledge. Well, that's exactly what the lam rim is, you know. So what we've been looking at very precisely is the essence of each of the scopes of practice, or as Lama Zoburumse politely, respecting the lineage, would call the first level. We tend to shorten it and call it the first scope, the lowest scope. You know, I call it junior school. He would say it's the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the least capability. And then you've got the middle scope, the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the middle capability, and then so on and so forth. And we've got the greatest capability. So another analogy, you've got the wisdom wing and the compassion wing. Well, junior school and high school, the first and second scopes, that's the wisdom wing. That's all the nuts and bolts of all the teachings that we need to apply to ourselves to help us, you know, begin the job of lessening delusions and growing the goodness by controlling our body, speech, and mind, abiding by the laws of ethics, which is the essence of the first scope, then understanding the mind, unpacking and unraveling the mind, which is the essence of the second scope. And then, of course, we add on compassion to the mix, and then we get to the six perfections, and then finally we get to, you know, in the six perfections, what we're doing is we're we're finally accomplishing the compassion wing. We're completing the accomplishment of the compassion wing. And in the last two of the six perfections, we're completing the accomplishment of the wisdom wing. And the combination of these two, the combination is Buddhahood. You get the job done. You now graduate, you know. So what we've been trying to point out the last few weeks, how many weeks it is if we look into karma, as I've been saying, the essence of the first scope of practice is abide by the laws of karma. That's when you begin to practice. Okay, you know, Tsongkhapa gets us to prime our minds first, thinking first about the necessity for a teacher. Then we think about the importance of the preciousness of this human life. Then we think about impermanence. Then we think about the lower realms. Then we think about refuge. We don't see the relationship. We can't see the psychological logic to the order of these points. So the order of all these points is to energize us not to want to waste this precious life. That's why those points are put where they are. But if you want to get the essence of the first scope, that's abiding by the laws of karma. That's when you actually begin to practice. The rest of it is to prime your mind to get you ready to begin to practice. So as I've been saying, the explicit, the overt teaching about karma is to get us to stop wanting future suffering. Because Buddha's telling us everything we think and do and say produces the person we become. We're our own creator. But what I've been trying to point out, and this is what comes as we continue to practice, as we continue to apply karma to our lives, what it does is very powerfully counteract the grasping at this self-pity victim me who didn't ask to get born, whose fault it is not, which is the way ego is. When we start to look at it, as Lama Yeshe would say very brutally, ego is self-pity me. I mean, it doesn't seem like that to us in the beginning, and it's a really tough practice to start taking responsibility. Well, that naturally enables us to become less a victim, to become more courageous, to take responsibility. And guess what? That's loosening the grip of ego grasping, because ego grasping is the self-pity me. So the implicit teaching of karma, and it's very direct, is because karma, which is cause and effect, is a first excellent example of the first level of dependent arising. And dependent arising is the king of logics to prove emptiness. And today we're going to talk about this directly. So already we're getting ready to get into emptiness by understanding karma. It might appear evident initially, but as you practice, it will become evident to us if we're practicing properly. Then we get to the second scope, the middle scope, and now we get to the root of the problem. Now we actually become a Buddhist. Morality, abiding, you know, being a good person is not unique to the Buddha. The view of it is pretty unique, the view of karma, but being a good person, not killing and not stealing and not lying, your grandmother does that, a good communist might do that, and a good Muslim or a good Buddhist. So it's not unique to the Buddha. But now we get to become actually a Buddhist when we start to abide by the, we start to become our own therapist, as Lama Yeshe would very nicely put it. In the middle scope, which is where we start to get into the root of what suffering is. In the initial stages, we're controlling the body and speech. Now which are the servants of the delusions. Now we get to the root of the problem and we start looking at all these branch delusions. We learn about the three poisons, the essence, you know, the three main neurotic states of mind that are the source of all the other neurotic states of mind. There's a very clear, coherent map of the mind in Buddhism. And these are the three main ones. So beginning to understand these, again, the overt teaching here, as we've been discussing, is that these are just deeply disturbing states of mind, and this should become the energy for us want to give up attachment and give up anger and give up jealousy because they disturb us. That's the tough one. But the deeper one, the implicit teaching, as I'm saying, as we become more familiar with being our own therapist and more familiar with the relationship between attachment and aversion, the two main, effectively the three poisons, okay, they're the root delusion, ignorance, this primordial, and we're going to get to this one finally, the root delusion, this ignorance, this very specific ignorance deep in the bones of our being that believes absolutely without question, so primordially, it's not even articulate for us, in a self-existent, real, solid, definite, concrete, separate me. On the basis of this, effectively the main cause of our suffering in day-to-day life, as far as the Four Noble Truths are concerned, is this attachment to get what that supposed me wants. And that's frantic. This attachment is immense and amazing. Lama Yeshe said, I could tell you about attachment for one whole year. You'll never begin to understand it. So, of course, initially we hear about it. It sounds very cute. Oh, I'm so attached to chocolate cake. Oh, I'm so attached. Oh, you know, so simple, but it's profound state of mind. This emotional hunger that runs the show day by day at the levels of deep assumption. And the assumption of attachment is, you know, I must get only the nice things, and we will do anything to get only the nice things. And then it gives rise, when we don't get the nice things, to the third of these three poisons, aversion. So even initially, we, you know, if we talk in daily life, if you go to your therapist and you talk about attachment and anger, there's no discussion about that in modern psychology. We don't even know what they're talking about. And it seems, even as Buddhists, it just seems they're two random, naughty states of mind, you know. But they're intimately connected. They're intimately linked. And we have to discover that from our experience. And how do you do that? By learning the words. You learn the theories. What is attachment? What is aversion? What is a delusion? How do they function? And then you start doing the job of putting meat on the bones in your daily practice, you know. And you start to identify the attachment, identify the aversion. And we run between these two 1,000 times a day. So this is, so the disturbingness is the key thing at this level. And that should be that should propel us to want to give them up. You know, to get renunciation of suffering and its causes. But the implicit teaching, as I've been getting to, and this is really crucial, is when we start to understand the deeper function of these neurotic states of mind, the overt one is they disturb us, and that should be enough reason to give them up. Although it's not for us, we're so addicted to them. But the deeper one is when we start to study Buddhist psychology, we study the model of the mind, we study Lo-Rig, we learn that the key function of all the neurotic states of mind, and Buddha divides all the states of mind into precisely three categories, the neurotic, deluded, ridiculous ones, the positive, virtuous, useful ones, and then the mechanics of the mind, concentration, intention, attention, all these necessary states of mind that any, whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you need. But we need to distinguish. The essence of the job of being a Buddhist is to distinguish between the neuroses and the virtues. So when we start to learn the Buddhist psychology, we learn Lo-Rig, we start to hear, you know, the definition of a delusion of a disturbing nature of state of mind is that it is a misconception. It is a misconception. And this is ridiculous to us. If you see a person shouting and yelling and you say, oh, they're having a misconception right now, you laugh at it. What do you mean? They're called angry. Look at them shouting and yelling. And this is our big problem with the disturbing emotions. We only notice the disturbing emotions when our body feels them, because we're so addicted to our bodies. We make the body the boss, as Lama says. But that's really gross. We need, and this is why we've got to have some good concentration, good discipline, so that we can begin to listen to the thoughts, the conceptual stories that inform those emotions. The emotion is just the tip of the iceberg. It's the thoughts, and they are misconceptions. So when we can start to understand how attachment is a misconception, it is a state of mind totally programmed from countless lives of practicing it, totally instinctive. You know, that's why it's almost like a joke to call it a misconception. That's deep in the bones of our being that we totally believe in and totally buy into. It's a story our mind tells us that when the eyes see that brown triangle and the mental consciousness labels it chocolate cake, and all the rest of the story comes flooding into your mind from habits because you're used to chocolate cake. You believe the chocolate cake is delicious. You believe it'll cause you happiness. And then in it goes the mouth waiting for happiness to come. And then three pieces later, you want to vomit and you don't even question any of it. This is the practice we have to do to unpack and unravel all these deeply ingrained habits to start to see the conceptual story that informs these emotions. This is really preparing us now to get to the six perfections. And we listen to how ignorance, we start to conquer ignorance now. This is where we have to learn to realize emptiness. And this is where we start to really begin to hear for the first time in the teachings about how ignorance is a misconception. But already all the delusions are misconceptions. But the Buddha wants us mainly to concern ourselves with the disturbing nature of attachment, not the misconception component. Whereas if you listen to Lama Yeshe's teachings and Lama Zopa's, you know, they're talking all the time about that. Attachment and anger are lies in the mind, and they lead us up garden paths. And when we really begin to understand this, we now understand why we suffer. This is the point. This is the point. We suffer because we are believing in totally ingrained eons old conceptual stories that come completely spontaneously without any evolution because they're so spontaneous, and they, and the lies are so deep and so ancient, and this is a tragedy, that they are so strongly ingrained in our mind that not only do we believe that, that even that lie causes the chocolate cake to appear delicious. So in other words, attachment, this is in the middle scope, attachment is a misconception that over-exaggerates the deliciousness of an object, in this case, the chocolate cake. So what happens is the eye consciousness sees shape and color. That's it. It can't see chocolate cake. But in a millisecond, your mental consciousness is accessed, and up comes this story. Chocolate cake, delicious chocolate cake. And then attachment kicks in. It's utterly divine chocolate cake. And totally instinctively, you believe it'll make you happy such when you get the chocolate cake. It's the cause of your happiness. So everything in you, all your parts of your mind, all work together to get the cake in the mouth. Not here, not here. You don't forget which hole it belongs to, this one. And then the expectation comes, waiting for happiness, you know. This is happening spontaneously, primordially. So the attachment is so strong that not only, you know, it causes the actual cake to appear in a way that it doesn't actually exist. And this is how Lama Zopa talks all the time. And this is how we're going to get to talk about ignorance, the root delusion, because it's the root lie. All the delusions are misconceptions. But this is, from the modern psychological point of view, this is not how we talk about mental illnesses. And the affliction, which is very medieval. Lama Yeshe never used it. I never used it. The better word is delusion or disturbing emotion or neurosis. Neurosis is a good one. He would have liked that nice Greek word. The function of these neuroses, they're disturbing, yes, but they're liars. That's why they're called delusions. The nail on the head, delusion. It's a brilliant word. These unhappy states of mind are delusional to the extent to which they're running the mind, and they're running the mind all the time, one way or another, especially attachment. To that extent, we are not in touch with reality. That's exactly how Buddha's talking. That's exactly how Buddha's talking. And that's what we have to understand. And this prepares, now it's easy to start to look into ignorance, the root delusion. So the root delusion, ignorance, ma-ripa, unawareness. So of course it's a very broad general word, isn't it? But it's got a specific definition here. It's the root ignorance. There are many kinds of ignorance in our minds. Of course there are. Such that when you've uprooted it, you have climbed out of your samsara into your nirvana. You can't fall back after that. You're not there yet. You've got more work to do, but that's a primordial change that has to happen. This massive shift in the mind. You now become what's called an Arya being. So, okay, how do we uproot it? How do we uproot it? This is where it's taught in the framework of the six perfections. The first four, as I mentioned, are the perfection of the various virtuous qualities in relation to sentient beings. So we're perfecting the compassion wing. And the last two are the perfecting of the wisdom wing. So the first of these, the fifth one, the first of the two, is called samatha. Calm abiding is the usual way it's translated. So as Lama Yeshe points out in his wonderful book, Mahamudra, How to Discover Our True Nature, which is a very delicious for getting to realize emptiness. You know, Mahamudra is an equivalent of emptiness, the word. It's a very delicious technique. And Lama talks about both of these. And he said, as he said, it's impossible to cut the root of ego grasping. Ego grasping is a colloquial as having an intrinsic nature. And we have to now, we're going to unpack these words. What does it mean we grasp the things having an intrinsic nature? There's many synonyms for that. We need to understand these words, which we're going to look into a little bit, the best I can. So this ignorance is the root of the problem. So, you know, this is where the Buddha diverged from the Hindus, actually. philosophy. They were amazing, these brilliant yogis centuries before, you know, more than 3,000 years ago. They're the ones, as His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, they're the ones who began the investigation into the nature of self. Not as we smarty pants white people think it was Mr. Freud, you know, 100 years ago. How pathetic. Only now are we honoring these incredible Indians, you know, not to mention the Buddhists, the Indians before. So they're the ones who created this amazing technique, this ingenious, brilliant psychological skill that enables you to completely subdue the grosser level of consciousness, including the sensory and the grosser level of conceptuality, and to totally get to a laser-like level of subtle focus, the likes of which we cannot even imagine, the likes of which is nothing in psychology at all, nothing like it, because it's a state of mind that we don't even posit as existing in modern psychology, because in modern psychology we talk about the brain. Okay, people are looking into these things, it's wonderful, but so far we haven't got anything like it yet. You know, these genius Indians got this one. The Buddha went as far as you could go with these Indians. They gave up the grosser level of suffering, they gave up the subtle level of suffering, they gave up attachment, but they didn't give up the root one. They went as far as they could go to the peak of samsara, but they didn't understand, had no view of emptiness. That's where the Buddha diverged into his own direction. Now we have so-called Buddhism, you know. So, of course, in Buddhism itself, there are so many viewpoints. One of the texts that you'll study in the monasteries, in which we indeed study in the centers, which is called Buddhist Tenets. You're laying out all these different schools of thought, all nice logically presented, you know, very many variations about, in fact, exactly the nature of self, about, in fact, exactly what is emptiness, what exists and what doesn't exist. So this is a key thing the Buddha talks about from the beginning to the end, what exists and what doesn't exist. And again, initially, this is an odd concept to us. You know, it's an odd, what do you mean what exists and what doesn't exist? But this is Buddha's whole deal. So, you know, when you study Buddhist philosophy, you learn especially the text called Dura. We don't study that in our centers unless we do it extra. It's not part of our basic program. But it's the very first text you'll study in the monasteries. Dura, collected topics. And there you learn this kind of of the Buddhist view of the world. And you learn, first of all, there's a term that you learn about that which exists. And there are several synonyms. One is called phenomenon. One is called object. One is called object. One is called existent. One is called established base. That's five. I don't think there might be more. I don't remember. But this is cruel. So why are we looking at these terms? That which exists. Why do we want to know about that? This is Buddha's entire point. He says we are suffering. There is the existence of suffering of all kinds, from the hell realms to the God realms to whatever you call it. Suffering across the board is the result of not being in touch with that which exists. So the very first level of practice, you don't even bother about the mind yet. You control the servants of the delusions. You calm your body and speech down. Then you start to get to the branch delusions and calm attachment and aversion and arrogance and jealousy and low esteem down and stop believing in those stories. And now we're ready to put compassion into the mix, and now we get to the six perfections, and now our minds are ready and ripe to really attack the root delusion, the root lie, the thing that finally is what prevents us from being in touch with reality, finally, ultimately. This is the way Buddha's talking, across the board, you know. So, we are now in this, first of all, let's talk about shamatha first, and then we have the sixth perfection, which is known these are two modes of meditation, basically. The first mode of meditation, the fifth of the six perfections, is called shamatha, calm abiding. And as I said, it's a name given to the brilliant skill invented by these Indians that Buddha took with him when he left and is still extant and existing and living in the Buddhist tradition. Every day, but people like you and me are attempting to get this concentration. And as Amiyeshi puts it, you cannot possibly unpack and unravel, my words, the root delusion until you get this single point of concentration. In other words, you've accessed the microscope of your mind, because only the microscope of your mind, only a super, this subtle, super focused, super stable level of consciousness beyond conceptuality, beyond the sensory, it's only that level of mind that's capable of seeing nakedly the mistake of ignorance. And it's not just enough to get concentration. You're going to have concentration till the cows come home. you've got to use insight, which is the sixth perfection, or the second of these two, the last two, the second of these constant, this meditation technique, which is known in general as insight. So there's calm abiding and special insight, or shamatha and vipassana. So in Buddhism, there's many, Lord Buddha taught many vipassana techniques, but there's one that's in the world that's most popular that tends to be people's assumption is that's what Buddha means by insight. But he taught many insight techniques. And the one that's the most popular, and I've never done it, I think it's a technique that Lord Buddha taught it, but you start and you use your concentrated mind, because these two techniques go together. We're going to discuss all this. But you get some concentration. Once you've got some concentration, you go to the second mode, and then what you'll do with your concentrated, focused mind, to whatever degree you've got concentration, you will then scan the sensations of your body. Now, why do you want to do that? Well, in our culture, we often mistake it because we're so addicted to our bodies, we think Buddha wants us to get insight into our body. Couldn't care less about the stupid old body. The body's in the way. The reason he wants us to get insight into the sensations of our body, so we get, not insight into that, to scan with our focused mind the sensations of our body, is so we can get insight into impermanence. So insight is not exclusive to emptiness. It's the particular technique we're using here. Special insight. They call it special insight, shlaktong in Tibetan. And it's insight into emptiness. So the methodology, the technique isn't to scan the experiences of the body. The body's very gross, but it's a good start. Here we're using the mind. So first of all, let's look at these two techniques and how they go together, because we get very confused. You know, because we don't use the word insight, we don't use the word calm abiding, we don't use the word meditation. We have all these concepts, and it's just very confusing to us. So the whole point is, what we're trying to gain here is an insight. By the way, insight in English is a great word. In some languages, I've noticed, there's no really equivalent in daily language. So it's kind of seen as some kind of weird, special religious word. But it's not. Look at the word insight. It's a wonderful word. You know, you're thinking through a problem, and you go, oh, I've got some insight into that problem today. It's a lovely, ordinary word we use in daily life. Insight, inner seeing. It's a wonderful word. We use it all the time. So don't mystify it, please. What are we trying to get insight into? Whatever it is, you've got to get insight into karma, insight into impermanence, insight into the way the mind works, insight into compassion. Insight is what you need in relation to all the topics in the Buddha's path to enlightenment, not just impermanence, not just in, you know, emptiness. But the insight that's taught in the end here in the Six Perfections is specifically this special insight, insight into the ultimate way that things exist, that is to say, emptiness. We're going to look at all these terminologies, you know. So a classic session of these, using these two types of meditation, whether you're trying to get insight into impermanence, death, karma, you name it, it's going to be exactly the same. So first of all, you've got to get some focus. Now, I mean, in our daily life, we don't say, oh, I'm going to sit down and do some concentration meditation before I practice music. I'm not going to go, you don't sit down and do your concentration meditation before you do your math homework. But you could argue like that. You know, in a sense, it's just the same, but we mystify it. So it's like this. Let's say you're a little girl at school and your teacher's teaching you that 1 + 1 = 2. Well, guess what? You've never heard that before. It's brand new information for you. I've never heard, oh, mummy, she told me today that 1 + 1 = 2. Wow. She wants me to get some insight into it. What do you think she's asked you to do, your teacher? She says, basically, go home, Rabina, and do your homework. What does homework mean? She wants to use your noggin to think it through. 1 + 1 =, you've got to know those words. And then at some point you go, aha, mummy, I've got an insight. Now I understand. That's what your teacher asks you to do. That's how we study everything. But we don't call it getting insight. We think it's some Buddhist kind of weird thing. Don't be ridiculous. We mystify so much, you know. So that's exactly what you do. You go home. Now, if you don't have a little desk to sit at, and if you don't have any kind of quiet, and your sisters are jumping all over you, like in my house, I never did any homework because I didn't even have any concentration. So at least your teacher, basically, if she's a Buddhist, she'll say, Rabina, go home, close your door, get your sisters out of the way, sit down, get some concentration, then open your eyes, and now I want you to get insight into 1 + 1 = 2. That's exactly what she'd tell you, isn't it? And you would do it. And that's how we learn violin, math, IT, cooking, everything. We are geniuses at getting insight, and we know damn well if you can't concentrate, you can do nothing. So concentration is an obvious prerequisite, but we don't call it meditation. So we must not mystify these things. It just happens to be these brilliant Indians invented this genius techniques for getting concentration. Anybody wants to be a good physicist or a good IT person, they benefit immensely from having single point of concentration. They become the most genius physicists on the planet because their concentration will be so blissful. But we think of it as religion. It's ridiculous. And that's why mindfulness meditation, which is the common term we use for concentration meditation, it's not Buddhist at all. It's not even religious. It's just a monkey could do it. A dog could do it. A bird needs very good concentration. So it's not religious in its nature, but we think of it as, oh, I'm doing my mindfulness meditation with my eyes closed. Somehow it's holy. Don't be ridiculous. Unpack this stuff, please. Be clear about it. But what you use it for is what makes it spiritual or not. You know, as Lama Zopa says, thieves need mindfulness. Mindfulness, concentration, attention, intention, discrimination, they're neither good nor bad. It's a question of why you do them that makes them useful, you know. So concentration, in order to get insight into anything, 1 + 1 = 2 or emptiness, you've got to get some concentration, baby. That's the first of the techniques. So then in your little meditation session, let's say you've been to the class, you've heard Geshe-la teach dependent arising, and you're kind of squeezing your brain, you can't quite work out what's going on. So then, ideally, like they do in the monasteries, as Lama Yeshe pointed out when he talked in Mahamudra, you'd hear the teachings, you'd go home, you'd discuss with your roommate, and then you'd sit down and you would meditate on it and internalize it. That's the best way to do it, you know, like your homework. You know, if you miss out your homework for 3 days and you hear the teacher talk again, you've lost the plot. So you'd go home, you'd get the after hearing Geshe-la's teaching, you'd got some you'd get some concentration, you'd do some shamatha to the degree that you understand it. So let's talk about it for a second, okay? This is, like I said, this genius technique that these Indians invented, that's still a living tradition in Buddhism. It's an amazing, marvelous technique. And as Lama Yeshe points out, and he always did this with us in the West, he tried to get us excited, you know? He tried to get us excited to want to practice. He tried to get us to see, and in this especially, when you start to do concentration, you could be forgiven for thinking you've achieved liberation because the qualities that you accomplish just by getting concentration are so astonishing, you wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe it, you know. It's like, as Lama Yeshe says, it's like unimaginable. It's inconceivable. But this is exactly, this is why it's so powerful and why Lama Yeshe would try to get us excited, to get us just to see simply the power of our own mind. Just getting concentration. Just getting shamatha. It's unbelievable. You would have a mind that is so radiant, so blissful, so vast. As Lama says, as if you could count every atom in the universe. When you've got concentration, you could sit there for weeks on end, absolutely essence, utterly undisturbed. You'd have utter joy, bliss, rapture, ecstasy. Lama knew all these words. He was amazing. This is the nature of your mind. It's how your mind is. To the degree that your mind is unencumbered by delusions and gross conceptuality and sensory is the degree to which your mind is blissful. This is very encouraging. We think bliss comes from the chocolate cake and the boyfriend. No. Bliss is the natural state of your own mind. This is what Buddha's telling us. It's amazing. We're discussing emptiness for a second. We're discussing just concentration. Now the Buddha says we've had it countless lifetimes. We've achieved shamatha so many lifetimes, but we didn't use it to cut the root of delusion, so we fell down the mountain and we've got to start falling up again, you know. We've had it countless lifetimes, but we haven't used it to get wisdom. This is our tragedy. And the other thing is you can get so blissed out. The bliss of the mind is so astonishing. It's the natural state of our mind when it's unencumbered by delusions to be blissful. I mean, I remember interviewing Venerable Rene. I don't know if he's ever been to North Carolina. This wonderful Swiss monk. He's been around for 40 years. That's a bit same as me, roughly, 45 years. And he started almost immediately heard the teaching. He started wanting to meditate, you know. So he was a monk at Nalanda. He studied for many years. He's done many retreats, off and on, all the years he's doing retreats and he's teaching alternatively. So I remember interviewing him in 1995 in Mandalay when I was the editor. And I remember he just finished, I think I had done recently, I don't remember how recent, was a 2.5-year concentration meditation retreat at Urselin, the place of clear light, the land of clear light, our lovely center, Lama Yeshe Center, Lama Zopa Center, just in the mountains in the Sierra Nevada, west, I think, of Granada. And we've had that since 1982. His Holiness Dalai Lama was there and he blessed it and he named it the place of clear light. That's when Lama Ursel was born. His parents came from there, the clear light. So it's a marvelous passage. He said it reminds him of Tibet. It's beautiful. So Venerable Rene was there for this 2.5-year concentration meditation retreat. And I interviewed him at Kopan Monastery. Well, there's several things I want to mention. But the key one was interesting. And this is the thing about the mind having this natural potential to be blissful. I mean, it sounds so peculiar to us. Blissful, rapture, ecstasy. It sounds like sex, you know. It sounds like naughty. We can't believe it. You mean you get ecstasy when you meditate? Oh, I'd like that. Well, yeah, you've got a concentration, baby. Yeah, it takes hard work. And this is the point. Just to, if you read Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, you read the Bhangra Rinpoche describing the prerequisites for a person to be, to get to the mountains, best metaphorically, but actually, which is the right condition to get concentration. You've already got to be a highly realized person, you know? And this is the point that Rene said. He said there was no way in the world he could have been ready even to want to even get to the mountains where he actually went and spent 2.5 years every single day, 8, 10, 12 hours every single day meditating on getting, you know, this concentration, which is described in terms of 9 stages of cultivation, you know, in the texts. I mean, already you have to have almost, as Pongpa says, you've got to be beyond complete attachment to any kind of food. I mean, that's hilarious for us in our culture. We might love sex and drugs and everything, but we love our food. And the fanaticism and the neurotic level of involvement we have with food, all our allergies and our this and our that and our nutrition and our blah, you've got to be at a point to be ready to go to the mountains where you couldn't care less about food. You eat whatever you're given and you shut up and you're happy, you know. That's pretty already sublime. You've got to have such discipline. And Rene said there was no way he would have been ready for this retreat had he not been a monk for many years, living in many vows, had he not done a lot of study, had he not even taught the teachings, and had he not done lots of purification. So you need so much, you need, your mind's got to be so ready to have the courage and the discipline and the confidence and the inspiration to do this enormously hard work of moving this mountain of a mind from one direction to another, to make it go beyond attachment and all this ridiculous neuroses, to want to just get concentration. It's incredible. You need such effort, such encouragement. And also you need to understand the teachings. I mean, as Swami Yeshi says in his Mahamudra book, I mean, this is back in the 70s, you know, when the hippies got all excited and wanted, heard about all this liberation business. A number of people, as Lama says, who learn to meditate and then end up in a psychiatric hospital, this is not a joke, because the mind is so stupendous, is so powerful, is so unknown to us. We have no clue what is going on in our mind. We have no way of unraveling and unpacking what's happening internally unless you've learned the Buddhist model of the mind, unless you've done bucket loads of purification practice, because intense stuff happens in retreats. You've got to know how to navigate it. You've got to understand what it is. So you can't just leap into meditation. And this is the point. So many people, there are so many stories, you know, people I've talked to, people I've, things I've heard about, people who've got some karma from a past life, let's say, to know how to meditate. They sit down and they can do it very easily. Or they sit down and they suddenly get lots of bliss. Now, this is the point. I mean, I met one fellow in prison who had some ability to concentrate for hours. He didn't learn it in this life. He just knew how to do it. That's obviously from past life, you know. But he completely was deluded. He had no idea what attachment was. He thought he was, you know, he thought he was the bee's knee. He thought he was Buddha already. He was completely deluded. He wrote a long letter to Lama Zopa all about his, how he's, you know, he's enlightened already. And Lama Zopa just told him to shut up and start doing some prostrations, you know. But of course he didn't listen. Because you go mad if you don't understand your mind. You don't know what you're dealing with. I remember one woman who, when she came to one center and she started doing the Tara meditation we did, and she got bliss. Well, she thought that was being religious. That's one of the biggest mistakes in spiritual practice. People equate feeling good with a spiritual realization. I mean, you feel much better with sex and you enjoy it with somebody else, okay? I'm, excuse me, being blunt. You know, it's ridiculous. Get more fun with an ice cream, God Almighty. But we're so deluded in our view of what meditation is and why you do it, you know. There's one guy, anyway, many stories, people going crazy because they don't understand how to deal with what arises in their crazy mind, you know. So the other thing that was interesting is, you know, the Buddhist view, and this is what Lama makes so clear in his Mahamudra teachings, is that the mind that, the less deluded our mind is, the more focused our mind, the less sensory consciousness, the less gross conceptuality, the more subtle, therefore the more blissful. This is just natural in Buddhist view. It's just natural. And that's hard for us to hear. We don't understand what to do with all that. And the other thing is just the mind is, when the mind, many people have even just a moment, have a good meditation, they're practicing very hard, and they might one day get some really good concentration. And they all say that when you've got the concentration, the mind is very blissful, but it's super, super peaceful. Now, if you think of bliss, if we use it in a gross way, even when you're slightly thirsty, just for a glass of water, your mind is berserk. So the more pleasure we tend to get, the more we get pleasure, the more berserk our minds. And this is what Buddha talks about. He says the pleasure we get now, whether it's the cake or the handsome boyfriend, the more the attachment, the more the pleasure, the more berserk, the more out of control the mind. There's no control whatsoever. Whereas this bliss that your mind is capable of in a, you know, serious practice, it's super, super undisturbed. It's super peaceful. So we, you know, and that's not something we normally experience in our daily lives, you know. Swami Lama talks about some of the extraordinary qualities. And of course, one of the major qualities we all get when we get concentration, get single point of concentration, not just a flash in the pan, but when you get it properly, stably, such that you can sit down every time and go straight to that state of subtlety. That's when you've accomplished it. And you can lose it, so you've got to keep practicing. You know, one of the things is that you've got, one of the qualities of a subtle mind is that it's clairvoyant. Now, this is kind of utter mystery to us. It sounds like hilarious, you know. But this is a natural quality of a mind that's more subtle. And this is the point the Buddha's asserting, that we have these subtler levels of cognition that, like I said before, we don't even posit in modern psychology or neuroscience, you know. And this level of mind is unbelievably powerful. We've not got realizations yet. We haven't got realized emptiness yet with this subtle mind. We're just looking at the qualities that you get. Just naturally, you see the past, you see the future, you see the minds of others. This is natural. This is natural. It's not religious. It's not spiritual. It's natural. But it's, we think it's spiritual in our culture because it's so weird, you know. So concentration. The only reason you want concentration is so that you've got this subtle laser-like focused mind, and now to the degree that you've got it in your session, you'll go now to the second mode of meditation, and now you will try to get insight into what? Into whatever topic you studied with Geshe-la that day. Let's say it's dependent arising, which we're now going to talk about. So then what would you do? So if you've got a good memory, like all these monks and nuns in the Tibetan tradition, they memorize everything. We can't memorize even our phone number. We've got to look at our course notes, don't we? So you've got your concentration, then you go to the second mode, you open your eyes, or if you remember, you take what you learn from Geshe-la. And what's that? That's a series of words, isn't it? Like 1 + 1 = 2. You've got to put these concepts together. You want them to ring a bell. You want them to make sense to you. You want to get an insight into their meaning. This is the homework you're doing, but you're doing it with a more focused mind in a concentrated meditation mode. But you take the argument, let's say, with dependent arising, and you would think it through. Now, we all know, if you're a Tibetan, or we tend to, a Tibetan Buddhist, what you tend to hear is the second mode of meditation is called analytical meditation. That really confuses us. Technically, it is called special insight meditation. But the point is, the method we use to get insight is analysis. But we get confused. Analytical meditation, we get all confused. Well, what's that, you know? Well, what do you think analysis means? The fancy Greek word for the verb to think about something. So that's what you do when you do your homework. Your 1 + 1 = 2, or your fancy looking physics. You think it through with your noggin, with your intellect, with your concepts. Then what happens? When you've got concentration, you think it through, the penny will drop. Oh, now I get it. That's the two modes of meditation together. You get your concentration, you go to the second mode, you take what you just learned in class, you think it through at a more subtle level because your mind's subtle, ideally, and then the penny drops. Suddenly the meaning becomes real to you. And if you, and there's a classic way of being in a retreat, you do your concentration, you go to your second mode, you take your topic, and you get ever deeper insight, ever deeper insight, ever deeper insight, until one day, one life, at one moment, you will finally get the subtlest insight, you'll get the subtlest level in your mind, and one day the penny will drop and you will get insight for the very first time, direct, non-conceptual, direct insight into the fact that that I that you have believed in since beginningless time has never, doesn't, and could never exist. That's your first moment of a direct insight into emptiness. You now start climbing out of your samsara into your nirvana. You have got a lot more work to do, but from there you become what's called a superior being. That's all we're aiming for. And then you have to perfect that. much more meditation. Could take you many more lifetimes. Who knows? Whoever you're at, you know. But you can't fall back after that. And that's what we've never done. So now let's look at dependent arising. Because it's in, now what we have to, what we're trying to get insight into, the shorthand is the word emptiness. And this is the one that throws us completely. So let's look into the meaning of this word, the use of this word. It's shorthand. So one of the best, this is where Tsongkhapa and his marvelous text of praise, his song of praise, you know, to the Buddha for his amazing teachings on dependent arising, basically the king of logics, as long as he paraphrases. So basically, to get insight into ultimate reality, and we're going to go to these words, emptiness, you need to use your noggin. You've got to use analysis. You've got to use logic. You've got to use many logical arguments. That's what you do at the conceptual level. But don't think it's only at that gross level. The mind, when it's very subtle, can also, when you've got single-pointed concentration, you don't just sit there spacing out. You can be effortlessly single-pointed without any thought at all, but you can utilize that laser-like focus to think about exactly what you like, but at such a subtle level, it's almost like a joke to call it thinking. But it is thinking, but it's super subtle conceptuality. And that's what you need to use. And when you've got that level of clarity, that level of focus, the level of duality you've got is super subtle, and it's quick to get insight into emptiness. It's quick to cut the nonsense delusions, to see the mistakes the mind has been making, you know? So, well, we've got to start at whatever level we are, which is at the very gross level with no concentration at all. So we use our conceptuality like we're doing this second, you know. So let's look at this king of logics. There's so many logical arguments, and we'll touch on a few of them, that we need to use. I've got to check the time. What's the time, Donna? Oh, here we go. 6 o'clock, 8 o'clock for you. And how? What time are we finishing? 9 o'clock.
Yes.
Okay, darling. How many more classes have we got?
One more.
Okay, good. Okay, so there's many logical arguments, and many in the monasteries they do this for years and years. When they study Madhyamika, the middle way, that's when their most intensive study, everything in the monastery leads up to that. That's when they really get into these teachings, you know, learning to get to the view. They get to the view, to cut the nonsense. So, okay, there are many logical arguments, but as Lama says, and as paraphrasing Tsongkhapa, the dependent arising is the king of logics. The king of logic to prove emptiness. So we're going to discuss that. We'll discuss other arguments as well. So, okay, so the context here, the framework here to get to understand dependent arising and emptiness, they're the two truths. So one way Buddha talks about the whole universe is in terms of the two truths, the things that are conventional and the ultimate reality. Well, one way of describing is all the emptinesses of everything are ultimate ultimate truths, and everything else is a conventional truth. Another way of talking is that everything that exists has these two modes of being. So there's lots of phenomena. There are lots of phenomena, objects of knowledge, existence, ENTS, established bases, these five synonyms for that which exists. And what we have to do is analyze how these phenomena exist ultimately in order to realize how they lack an intrinsic nature. So let's look at the object called I. This is our favorite object, our favorite phenomenon, our favorite object of knowledge, the one called I. So what does this mean? Okay, well, first of all, if you want to discuss anything, you need to discuss, you know, you need to know the name of it. You need to know what it is, which means you have to know its definition. So then we can be on the same page and then we can discuss it. So if we're going to discuss, let's say, you'll say, what's that, mummy? And she'll say, well, darling, it's called a thermos. And then, of course, that's the label for it, but I'm not happy yet. I'll have to tell her, I'll say to her, mummy, what is it? This is the definition. She has to give me the definition. So one way of putting it is a definition of something has two parts. The first part will tell you its conventional characteristics. Or she'll say, well, darling, look at it. It's this flat-bottomed metal container. Now, that's good. I can see it. But I'm not happy yet. I don't know what it is and its bones. This is a really good, it's really powerful. I don't know what its function is. I don't know what its meaning is. I don't know what its job is. When you say, but what is it? That's what you mean. It is a flat-based metal container, but you don't know what it is yet. But mummy, darling, what does it do? And she will tell you the second part of the definition, and this is its function. Now, this, in terms of understanding these two truths, is a major point to understand. Because they say that when you finally realize emptiness, ultimately, conventionally, things still function. So there's not a contradiction. So we're going to go into all this. So, okay, you now know what a thermos is, but don't believe your mother. You've got to now, she's got to prove it to you. Don't just believe what she tells you. We'll believe anything anyone tells us. We're idiots. So she's got to prove to you. She's got to tell you the second part. So I forgot to say, what is the second part? What is its meaning? What does it do? Well, sweetheart, it keeps my tea warm. So now she's got to prove it. So she'll put the tea in there. She'll put the lid on. She'll leave it for 2 hours, and we'll come back and we'll open up the lid and we will test it and we will prove that it fulfills its function. It kept her tea warm. But even then, I should not be satisfied. I should not be content yet. We should then check if there's any other definition in the world that we exist in for the term thermos that is a valid cognition. And if there's not, then we tick the box, we shake hands, and now we agree on the conventional truth called a thermos. Now, first of all, Buddha's telling us, we don't even get conventional reality right. We're living in la-la land about most things. So really one argument you could say is working through the lamb rim, at least we're trying to get sorted about what is conventionally true, you know? Conventionally, already we're on the right track. So let's look. There's millions of phenomena in the universe, and there are millions of new ones being invented every day. I mean, I always think of Steve Jobs. I'm sure the content of the universe must have tripled since Steve Jobs invented iPhones and iPads. And look at all the apps that exist in the universe. Who'd heard of an application before Steve Jobs? Now they're totally real reality. There are billions of them. Look at all the language in IT now. Before computers, none of that existed. So every day we are creating new conventional phenomena. That's cool. Nothing wrong with that. So let's look at the conventional phenomenon that we call me, I, self, person. These words are synonymous. So a dog is one of those. A human is one of those. A Buddha is one of those. A hell being, an ant. They're all persons. They're called the name that they're given, not as a thermos. The name we are given is a person, a self, an I, a me. These are synonymous. That's a conventional term given to this phenomenon. Each of us is one of those. We're not a thermos. We're not a toilet. We might treat ourselves like toilets sometimes, and we're not a toilet. So then, I don't know, I can't think of what the definition of a person is. I forget now, but never mind. We should know, but I can't think of what it is. It's sort of funny and boring. But we can assume we are one of those. I mean, we are also mind possessors, but technically the term sentient being is not given to a Buddha. For some reason, it's only ordinary beings get the term sentient being. But one thing that does define us as a person is a mind, isn't it? I mean, we've got a mind, you know. When the body is dead and there's a bunch of flesh there and there's no mind, you don't call it a person, you just call it a bunch of flesh. It's a corpse, isn't it? We get rid of it as quickly as possible. So person is a label that we use, or I. The favorite word is I, you know. So let's look at this I first as a convention. Conventional truth, a convention. A convention is by agreement, isn't it? We all agree. When you establish what a thermos is, you agree upon it. When you establish what an app is, look at it. This is how things work. We agree. It's this, it's this, it's this. We all sign off, we shake hands, and then we communicate about it, you know. That's conventional reality. So, let's look at how this I exists conventionally as the as a dependent arising. This is really the term, the shorthand for how things exist conventionally. And we're going to look at how the I exists conventionally in order to realize its ultimate character, its final character, its absence of inherent I. These are the words we have to get used to, you know? So that's why dependent arising is the king of logic to prove emptiness. So right now, so these are the two truths, conventional and ultimate. So as the Buddha's saying to us right now, we've got the two extreme views in our mind. As soon as we hear, so it's in general here, as soon as we hear that Buddha says there is no thermos from its own side, that's emptiness. We're going to get to all these words. We'll go, oh, well, there's no thermos, and we chuck the baby out with the bathwater, and we become nihilistic, and we say there's no thermos, might as well kill myself. And that's our wrong view as soon as we hear the word emptiness. So then as soon as we hear conventional, dependent arising, there is a thermos that does exist in dependence upon various factors. We're going to go into those. If there does exist a thermos in dependence upon various factors, when we hear that, we go, oh, thank God there is a thermos, grasped. And we grasp to the other extreme of concretizing, of making it absolute and permanent and solid. So these are the two extremes. Emotionally, we run between all the time, up and down like yo-yos. We're all kind of bipolar when it comes to reality, you know. It's either nothingness or somethingness. And we kind of wish Buddha would make up his mind, you know. Well, is there a thermos or is there not a thermos, Buddha? Because when you read the words, it sounds like he's contradictory. There is a dependent arising thermos, but there's ultimately no thermos. What does this mean? And this is the key thing we have to start to get to start to realize that these two are actually pointing to the same thing. When we really start to get on track in understanding dependent arising and emptiness, not as separate, not as opposites, which is how the ego feels now, but we see that they're bringing us to the middle way. The real middle way is when these two finally, when you're a Buddha, finally these two are simultaneously cognized. There's no longer a contradiction between conventional and ultimate. There's no longer a contradiction between dependent arising and emptiness. These are the words for it, okay? So we start, and this is why it's such a powerful logic, because the instinctive approach to emptiness, the biggest mistake, it seems, they say in the literature, in the minds of people, the biggest mistake is to hear that it means nothing. This is the biggest mistake. This is falling into the abyss of the great mistake, as Tsongkhapa says, you know. So let's look at this. Okay, so the Buddha, he basically, there's hundreds of ways that things, he points out hundreds of ways in which things exist interdependently. But he's got three key presentations that are really a summary of his arguments with the prevailing views, the Hindu views before. And the very first one, and this is where karma comes in, there are three main ones. The very first level of dependent arising is that, use the eye, or the thermos, same argument, that the I come into existence in dependence upon countless causes. Well, that's karma. This is the most powerful example of dependent arising. Instead of this, I am an innocent victim, I didn't ask to get born, this concrete sort of lump of me was plonked onto this planet to whom things happen unfairly. That's the view we have. But it's hard to realize I'm a product of causes and conditions, and that you cannot find any I among any of those thousands of causes. You start to loosen the grip. Where's the I, you know? This is why I remember Geshe Tekton, my philosophy teacher, whom I studied with in the late 70s in England. He was the abbot of our monastery in France for 10 years, Nalanda. He passed away now. Then he was the abbot appointed by His Holiness, the abbot of Sarah Jay, for 7 years. They get this 7-year appointment, so the lamas, you know. And he was my philosophy teacher. I remember he used the example in talking about dependent arising and causes. He used the example of the phenomenon called Rabina. And he said, it can be said that everything in the universe up to the first moment of the object called Rabina can be said to be a valid cause for the existence of Rabina. I mean, that sounds pretty cosmic, right? But if you start to think about it, it's logic. You start to think of the main cause of Rabina. Well, it's her mother, let's say. Well, my mother had a mother, and that mother had a mother, and you can never find the first mother. You're going to go back to beginningless time of mothers. Then you've got a father. Then everything you look at, her hands, her body, the flesh, her eyes, her mind, all of them have got countless previous causes, this unbroken chain of causes going back and back and back and back and back. So it's a pretty intense concept, you know. But we're looking all the time among those causes for this little eye in there. You won't find one. So then you've got the second level, and we're going to go to this argument now. This is the one that's so delicious. This is not the subtlest yet. It goes like this, that I exists, the conventional I exists in dependence upon its parts. So we all know, the Buddha's view, there are two parts of a person, the body and the mind. That's it, body and mind. They're the components. Now, we know the body has got countless parts and the mind has countless parts. What are the parts of the mind? Well, love, compassion, anger, jealousy, this moment of mind, that moment of mind, the moment of mind before. There's millions of parts of the mind, pieces that make up a mind. There are millions of pieces that make up the body. This is a crucial one. It kind of sounds fairly obvious and rather boring. What do you mean I exist in dependence upon its parts? Well, because why? Because Buddha's arguing here with a position that says that there is a self or a soul or an I or an intrinsic Atman that is partless and permanent and unchanging. And he's arguing with this. He says that's utter nonsense. That's not viable. That can't be how it is. That's his argument about the way and nature of a creator. A creator, by definition, has no cause. The Catholics spend an intense amount of time arguing philosophically for how there can be a first cause, capital F, capital C. Buddha argues with this. There's not a possibility. These are hugely important analyses we need to do to break the grip of this ego grasping, you know, because he says it's not a viable way. Things cannot exist like that. So what's a real, this is a really powerful, this is the one we see in Pabonka, in Liberation of the Palm of Your Hand, you know, we have to do this analysis. And he's basically, Buddha's telling us is this. We, because of this ignorance in the mind, this maripa, this self-grasping, we believe utterly and completely and instinctively, primordially, all the time, that there is in here somewhere, as my friend Kende says, walking hand in hand with all the other parts, a very special part called I. Our language expresses this. I have a nose. How dare you do that to me? I is out the central player in our head. Everything happens to this me, or this me does this, you know? So naturally, this is the thing now, when we say a word, you say a word, you say a sentence, you say, this is another argument they talk about, if there's something that is existing, it has to be one thing or more than one. It has to be one or many. And it sounds rather boring initially, but you listen, it's a good argument. So if I make it, I'll make a statement. I have a skinny picture, I can't do much. I usually go to the sideways picture. I've got to squeeze everything in. I will say, I have a thermos and a phone. Now, as soon as you hear me say those sounds out of my mouth, you naturally are going to check that I spoke the truth. It really helps if when words come out of a mouth, that those words are in sync with reality. We're talking conventional reality here. If I say I have an elephant in my right hand, you'll feel very sorry for Rabina. She's spoken nonsense. It's clearly not true. So it's really obvious that if I say a statement, we want to prove that that statement is true. Now, how many phenomena did I just say? It's pretty obvious, isn't it? I said three. I said three nouns. Okay, one's the pronoun. Phenomenon and sort of nouns are like phenomena. The mind cognizes nouns. Kind of interesting. You're going to check this out. You're going to see. The mind cognizes things as nouns. The mind cognizes things as phenomena, objects, things. So I said three things. I said I, number one, thermos, number two, phone, number three. So you will tick the boxes pretty quickly and you will agree that Rabina spoke the truth. And you will point out three, this is the point now, separate, independent things, won't you? And what does that mean? That means that there's a thermos that doesn't depend for its existence upon a phone or a Rabina. Rabina can drop dead, the phone can stop working, the thermos is fine. The same with the phone. It's independent and separate. And this is a simple example. It does not depend upon Rabina for its existence. There is no dependent relationship whatsoever. That means these are separate and independent. They're separate and independent. They're different and independent. It's pretty simple. Now I'll make another statement. We'll get a bit subtler now. This gets the tricky bit. I want to make another statement. I have a nose and an ear. Now, initially, without analysis, you can see pretty quickly that that's a truth. But we have to unpack that because there's an untruth in there. How many phenomena did I mention? I mentioned three. I said I, number one. Ear, number two. Nose, number three. That means we have to point out three separate independent phenomena. Well, there's the ear. It does not depend upon a nose to do its function of listening. Okay, at subtle levels, all the parts of the body depend. But at a simple level, my ear could go deaf, my nose keeps breathing air. My nose breathes without depending upon the ear. So that's two phenomena. Now we have to point out the third phenomenon that is not the nose and is not the ear and doesn't depend upon them. And indeed is not the eye and the hair and the mouth and the other millions of bits. And that's what we think exists. We think in here there is definitely a separate independent eye. This is the grossest mistake. But we can't even see this mistake because it's so primordial. We believe there is an eye in there that is the owner of the nose, that is the owner of the ear. We speak it. I have a nose. Now, this is one of the arguments. If Donna says, oh, Rabina, your nose is so ugly. And I will say, how dare you insult me, Donna? And she will say, accurately, Rabina, I didn't insult you. I insulted the nose. And we will all laugh at that because we assume without analysis, this is the point, that there is an eye in here. It feels like it. She just insulted me. So it's like this. If the nose hurts, it's like the ear is watching and going, oh, phew, I'm glad it's not me. Your ear's not having any problem at all. Well, if there is an eye in there that we think is there, that is a separate part that runs everything, it won't mind either if the nose is punched or insulted. That the eye will say, oh, phew, I'm glad you didn't insult me. Because we laugh at this, because we say, oh, but there is an eye. But we've never checked. This sounds hilarious to us. The Buddha says, I'm sorry, honey, if there is an independent separate eye in there, kindly point it out to me. Come on, start searching. And this is the argument that Pavonka puts. This is the four-point analysis. We understand this. The four-point analysis. The first one, and this is the most difficult one, if we've got the first one down, we can realize pretty quickly there's no intrinsic eye. But the first point is first establish what you think it is that you're going to search for. So, of course, it's a bit tricky because we say, but excuse me, Buddha just says there's no eye. So what do you mean I've got to establish what I think the eye is? Well, we've got to establish what we think the eye is because we certainly believe in it so that we can argue with it, so we can counteract it. You know, if I say to you, please go and get my iPad, I left it on the table, and you've never heard of an iPad, but you're too embarrassed to admit, and you walk in and there's 400 things on the table, you could spend 100 years searching, but because you don't even know what an iPad is, how can you search for one? Okay, an iPad's easy because it does exist, but as soon as you know what an iPad is, you can see pretty quickly, is there an iPad on that table? And you will come out and will only have two options. Rabina, there's either no iPad, you just found the absence of an iPad, or she will hand me my iPad. That's it. That's the same with the eye. The Buddha's saying, if there is an eye in there among the other parts, you need to find it. This is the main analysis we have to do, to search for the eye. But of course, it sounds so hilarious to us. But you've got to establish what it is first. And that's the part that's tricky. Now, I like to use the analogy. I love the latest example I'm using these days, which is that you go to IKEA. So Donna decides, she looks up on the computer and she sees a really nice product called Donna, and she wants to buy a Donna. So we know, well, first of all, you get to IKEA and you're very disappointed because all you get is a box of bloody parts, isn't it? You know, you don't get the Donna at all. She's got to create her own Donna. Well, this is a good example. So we know perfectly well that IKEA engineers or whatever, designers, they know exactly how many parts make up a Donna. And obviously with a human, it's hundreds and thousands of parts. And we know exactly when they give you those parts for that table, they don't just randomly chuck in five legs and two tops and four screws and you've got to cross your fingers. No, they know exactly the parts that belong to a Donna. So as you're creating the donor, and this is a reverse process to looking to the eye, the usual way is you have to unpack the eye, looking unpack the components to look for the eye. Well, here we're going to build the donor. And so, of course, as she's putting the leg together, the nose, the eyes, she's constantly hoping she's going to uncover the little piece that's called an eye, without which how can there be a donor if you don't find an eye? But she will construct a complete donor, and donor will work perfectly, and then not one of those pieces that make up donor will be called I. You know what? The Buddha says, not only will you not find a piece called I, honey child, you do not need one. It's an extra piece, like an extra bell and whistle that we have made up quite literally. Now, this is not the subject meaning of emptiness yet. And it's not nihilism. This is the point. Oh, well, there's no I. I might as well chuck it in the bin. This is the point. So this is the one point. This is one of the arguments you have to ask and use and analyze. If there were a piece in here that is labeled I, that is not the nose, it is not the ear, it is not the mouth, it is not anger, it is not jealousy, it is not love, and that's what the Christians would say. They call it a soul. That's what the Hindus call it, an Atman. The Greeks call it an essence, you know. We assume there's that thing there. But the Buddha says you don't need one. Donna will function fine. In other words, if there's a good hand and a good leg and a good bones and there's love and kindness, all the bits of the mind, all the eyebrows, everything will work immaculately and will function as Donna, but you won't find any Donna-ness there. And of course, this leads you to the subtlest one, that there is a Donna, but not intrinsically. You can't point to Donna. You can't point to a piece called Donna that's separate and independent. So there is an I, but it's not, you can't separate Donna from the parts. Donna's the name of her eye. Ravina's the name of my eye. So there is a Donna, but you can't separate Donna from the parts. The base for the lake, because the base, the parts is the base for the label Donna. The base, the parts, the leg, the eye, the ear, the nose, all the bits and pieces that make up Donna that IKEA built very nicely, they are the basis of the name Donna. So there is Donna, but not from her own side. There is Donna that does exist in dependence upon the parts, but they're different, but they're not separate. You can't separate Donna from the parts. I mean, it's really clear with the thermos. My thermos has a base. That's a true statement. Look at it. It has a base. So there's two nouns there, aren't there? There's thermos and there's base. So we want to find the base and we want to find the thermos. But as soon as you take the base away, there's a base. Where's the thermos? It's just a label you give to the base and the part and the top and the bits. So this is the subtlest meaning of emptiness. As His Holiness says, Donna, I, called Donna, Donna is not empty of existing from her own side, because you can't find Donna. You won't find any Donna, but that is not the real premise. Donna is empty of existing from her own side because she is a dependent arising. That's the king of logic. So the subtlest dependent arising, of course, is merely labeled. And Lama Zopa only ever talks about this, you know. So the thing is, so there's lots of, okay, this is just a summary of a few things. So why don't we leave that there, turn the page, and then we'll take a different tack, okay? We'll look at it from a different point of view. Let's look at the word emptiness, because this really confuses us. So let's get back to the term object, phenomenon, object of knowledge, that which exists. So the definition, this is so tasty, the definition of an existence They've each got their own definition. They're all synonyms, but they've got, they're all a different take, you know, on things. So the definition of an existence, of something that exists, this is a definition. This shows the centrality of mind in Buddhism. The definition of an existent is that which can be cognized by mind. That's axiomatic, that if something exists, it can be known and cognized by the mind. That's tremendous, you know. So, okay, now, let's look at the word emptiness. As soon as we hear it, we hear nothing. We hear it as nihilism. But it's not like that. Let's just use a simple, I use a simple example of my thermos, and this will use the example of, let's say, Donna's colorblind. And whenever black appears to her eyes, because her eyes are messy, they're all wrong, she sees pink. Let's just say, okay? Let's just say. So we know, because the way eyes work, and we know the convention, we all agree this is called black. Now, Donna might even know it's called black, but she can't help it, because it appears like pink to her. So she believes it's pink. She's only ever believed it's pink. So a pink is what appears to her. So how do we help poor Donna get to see reality? We can't bully her into knowing it's black when really all she sees is pink. It's kind of a problem. So we fix the problem. And in this case, it's something simple. It's her poor little eyes. So we get her done surgery, and then she's, now her eyes are fixed. Okay, now her eyes are correct. And again, I will show her this thermos. So we naturally will go, oh, but now she'll see the truth. She'll say, oh, look at that, that's black. But you know, she won't say that. And listen to this point. This is the point. She will get the shock of her life, and she will go, oh my God, it's not pink. Crunchy. Because her eyes are okay, she's seeing the right color for the first time, but conceptually, because she's so familiar with believing it's pink, she will get the shock of her life because she expects pink, and she actually, the phenomenon that she will cognize is called the absence of pink. The emptiness of pink. That's what she will cognize. And it's a conceptual concept. So it's a concept, isn't it? Let's say she believes there's $5,000 in her bank. She knows there's $5,000. She saved it. She put it there. She utterly believes in the presence of $5,000. And let's say she then looks in her statement because she wants to get the money out. And she goes into the, not her statement, she goes into the bank, puts the password in. And then listen to this. What is there is a zero. Okay? It's a zero. Now, she will see the zero in the first millisecond, but what she will really see, the object of knowledge that is presented to her mind, will be the absence of her precious $5,000. We understand this. If I'm going to drink my tea in my thermos, I'm all excited expecting tea, and I go like this, and I go, oh, my thermos is empty. Think about this. You don't walk into the crockery shop. I always forget what we call it in America. In England, we call it crockery, the cups and saucers. You don't walk into the cups and saucers shop and mummy, you go, oh, mummy, all the cups are empty. No, because you know why you don't say that? And this is the really crucial point now, because you don't expect them to be empty. I don't expect this black thermos to be pink. So my eyes are already working fine, and I will see the conventional phenomenon called pink. It is not, I mean, I will see black. It isn't pink. But I won't see a thing called absence of pink because I didn't think it was pink in the first place. But Donna, because she's expecting pink, and she's now going to see the truth, she's now got the realization of truth. So she will see the absence of pink, and then she will see the truth, which is black. This is how it happens when you're realizing emptiness. So the Buddha's telling us that there has never been, isn't, and could never be an intrinsic I, an independent I, an inherent I. We've got to go into all that. That's the name of the I that we think is there. He says there isn't that one, but we have to prove it. So when you do all your analysis and you get your single point of concentration and your meditation, and then one day in Donna's single point of concentration after years and lifetimes of practice, one day she will have removed the subtlest imprint in her mind and she will see nakedly for the very first time the absence of the I she thought was there. She just saw then the absence of the pink that she thought was there. When she looked in her bank, she saw the absence of the $5,000 that she thought was there. If you're looking for Mary in a room, and you're looking for the people in a party, you know, in a room, and you open the door, you go, oh, the room's empty. Well, you know, you don't just look in every room that has no people in it. You're not expecting people. You don't say the room's empty. You only say the room is empty. The only person who says the room is empty is a person who's expecting people. The only person who sees the bank account is empty is the person who is expecting $5,000. So these are emptinesses that are sad ones. But what if Donna's told she's got cancer? So suddenly she's facing the reality that she's going to die. She has to let go of her husband and the Dharma sent all her friends, and she's trying to get used to this idea she's going to die. She believes in the presence of cancer in her body. She believes it utterly, completely, and acts according to that belief. She's devastated. She's trying to get used to it. She's trying to come to terms with the presence of cancer. And then she goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, sorry, Donna, we gave you the wrong x-rays. There is no cancer. Well, what Donna just had a cognition of is the absence of cancer. Of course, that's a happy absence. She'll be blissed out. So as Lama Zopa says, the greatest yogi, when they see for the first time nakedly at a subtle level of their mind, see with absolute certainty the eye they've been living in for 40 billion eons has never, could not, and does not exist. He says the bliss they experience is unimaginable. The lesser yogis have incredible fear, but it's a good fear. So emptiness is the name of a phenomenon that does exist. If there were $5,000 in Donna's bank, then $5,000 is a phenomenon that does exist. And if there's no $5,000, which is what she expects, then the phenomenon that Donna is cognizing is a negating phenomenon, and it's called the absence of $5,000. That's a valid phenomenon that does exist. So emptiness is not meaning nothingness. It means the absence of something. And in Donna's case, it's the absence of $5,000. It's the absence of pink. It's the absence of people. It's the absence of cancer. So it's a vivid, powerful, existent phenomenon. But it's like a negative number instead of a positive one. So it doesn't, it's sort of not like, as His Holiness says, you're kind of looking for the eye, and this will happen. She will look for the piece in the IKEA box. She'll see the hundreds and thousands of pieces, and she's searching frantically, and she will not find any piece called eye. She'll chuck out all the other pieces and go, there's no eye. I might as well kill myself. Dalai Lama says, it's not like that. You will find the absence of the I you expected to be there, but then you will realize dependent arising. Then you're on the right track. Listen to this one. The $0 is a good analogy for nihilism. It is meaning nothing. It means nothing. So let's say she asks me to look in the bank. Tell me where, just double check my $5,000, Rabina, is it there? And I will say, I don't know, no, I'm sorry, I don't expect $5,000. She just says, look in my bank account for me, please, Rabina. And I will tell her the truth, that there's no dollars there. So the object that appears to my mind is nothing, zero. That's what I cognize, nothing. And it's true in this case. But that's not what Donna cognizes. Donna will cognize the absence of her precious, precious $5,000. So the absence of $5,000 is not zero. They're two separate phenomena. So the absence of an inherent I is a very vivid phenomenon. It's not, oh, there's no I, kill myself. I've got to understand this, you know. So I think it's time for questions. I've been shouting for a good hour and a bit. What time is it? God, an hour and a half already. So come on, a few questions now about concentration or about anything you've heard already. And we've just begun the discussion about emptiness. So just whatever the questions you'd like so far, please ask me some things.
Venerable, there's a question on YouTube, so this person won't be able to interact, but I'll read the question for you.
Good, darling.
It is, isn't the I my consciousness? And isn't that the part of me that feels ownership over all the other parts of me?
Very good question. It's a very good point. It's almost like if you want to find an I, you're going to find the mind. But no, it cannot be the I. And let me give you a simple reason why. If you say the mind, okay, let's start. Let's look at the parts of an I. What's this person give their name?
I don't know the first name. T.E.
Okay, listen, T.E., honey, whoever you are. T.E. is the name we're giving to you. So what are the parts of T.E.? Because T.E. is the name given to the person. Donna's the name for that person. So what are the parts that make up T.E.? Listen to this. The parts that make up T.E. are body and mind. What are the parts that make up a thermos? The sides and the base. Let's just say, and the top. The three parts. So same thing here. Well, let's talk about you first. So we're looking for an intrinsic I. It's a name. Basically, Buddha's saying it's a name. T-E is equal I for you, okay? T-E is you. So T-E, you're looking for a T-E in there. Now, you've got the body and you've got the mind. And you're suggesting, because the mind is obviously the one that continues, it's more powerful, it's the one that cognizes, it's obviously very powerful, the mind, you're right. And you're thinking, well, maybe because of that, the mind must be T-E. Okay, but we first just said we posited the phenomenon called T.E. And then we looked at the parts that make up T.E. One is the body and one is the mind. So if the mind is a part that makes up T.E., T.E. can't be the mind and mind can't be T.E. They're separate phenomena. So if you say that T.E. is the same as mind, then you're saying, well, T.E. and mind are synonymous. That means T.E. owns a T.E. or mind owns a mind. It's absurd. Why would you say that? So no, your mind is not T.E., but the mind is a valid base that continues from life to life, that is a valid base for the label I. In this life it's T.E., next life it might be Mary, who knows what. So that's the point. And in a way, all the earlier thoughts, this is a different views about emptiness, and here we're discussing the Majjhimika Prasangika view, which is a view that our lamas teach us. So all the earlier views, the previous views in Buddhism, there are many views, they all posit that there has to be something that bears the label I, and they would all posit some part of the mind. But the Prasangika Majjhimika says you cannot do that, and you don't need to find something in there that is the I, because T.E. is merely the label we give to those parts. That's the answer to you. It's one answer anyway. Anything else there, Donna? Anybody else? I can't see any of you except six of you. So any of you other people got questions? Anybody at all? Yes,
I have a
Linda,
question.
I can see Linda. Yes,
oh, hi. Hi, Venerable. In follow-up to what you were just talking about, what about the mind and, you know, it's not stagnant or permanent. There's, you know, it changes every moment. So
that's right.
So does
that's right.
That tie to that as well, that that there's not an I, or the
because
mind
it's impermanent.
Is not I?
Because it's impermanent, you mean. Yeah, that's a valid reason, but it's not enough reason to realize emptiness. It is a truth. And it's a good starting point. All the lamas will say, we start to realize this subtle impermanence of constant movement. It's a very good stepping stone to understand the subtler understanding of inherent existence. So impermanent is a grosser level, and realizing impermanence will cut a lot of suffering, but it won't get to the root of the suffering. That's the answer. That's a good point, though. Thank you. And in fact, many of the schools of thought, some of the school's understanding of subtle impermanence in one school is the view of emptiness in the grosser, in the earlier school. So they conflate, they mistake that subtle impermanence is emptiness. And this is a common mistake that can be made. But emptiness is a subtler meaning. But impermanence is a great stepping stone. Yes, Lorna.
struggle.
So is mind permanent, even though it changes all the time?
I understand.
It's still mind?
It's a very good point. This is where we need to understand the use of these terms in Buddhist philosophy, Lorna. The term permanent is a very real word in Buddhist philosophy, but it hasn't got the same meaning that we give it. So in other words, we've got, in Buddhism, there's impermanence, and there's subtle impermanence, and there's a grosser level of impermanence. So the grosser level of impermanence is the evident one, that things change from moment to moment. But things that are impermanent are the product of causes, and they're dynamic and moving and changing. So the opposite of that we would naturally think is permanent. Now, okay, one understanding we have in our ordinary thought is if it's impermanent, it doesn't last, right, isn't it? It doesn't last. But no, impermanent means changing from moment to moment. So consciousness, which is beginningless and endless, in that sense, we'd say permanent, but that's not the meaning. It's impermanent in its nature of being dynamic moment by moment. But permanent in Buddhism doesn't mean lasting forever. Permanent is the opposite of changing from moment to moment. And in normal world, mind and all the phenomena that we know about in daily life, they're all impermanent. There's no such thing as nothing can have the characteristic of permanence. But the Wisdom Way gets tricky. Negating phenomena, the absence of something. This is not meant to be just kind of squeezing your brain. The absence of something, such as emptiness, or even for this moment, the absence in your mind of, say, anger. We can maybe look into your mind, you'll see there's no anger in your mind. Well, we could argue there is no anger in your mind, but there is in your mind the presence of the absence of anger. You can talk like this. It's a very proper way to talk. That phenomenon called the absence of something, the absence of blue, the absence of money, the absence of anger, that phenomenon isn't an impermanent phenomenon. It doesn't change from moment to moment. It has not got a cause. This seems a bit weird to us, but it's a very major thing we learn to discuss in order to get us to understand this abstract phenomenon called the absence of an inherent I. So, but in conventional terms, there's no permanence. The things that we understand in daily life, like our mind and all the things that come and go, they're all impermanent in their nature insofar as they change from moment to moment. That's the real characteristic.
I understand. Don't, thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you, Lorna. What else, dearest people? Wish I could see you all. Any other questions? Or we can keep talking. Let's discuss. Let's go more to this word. What is it? What time is it? Okay, we're fine. Okay, so let's just look more. When they talk about, we all know the language, we're trying to realize emptiness, it says, you know. So what we're trying to get to see, what we're trying to cognize, realize is just a particular word for a level of cognition that's kind of certain, you know. There's many levels of cognition. Cognition is the function of your mind. The verb to cognize, the verb to know, the verb to be aware, they're all synonyms. It's a function of your mind, the bare bones function. So all the parts of our mind cognize in different ways. And so, of course, what Buddha is telling us is we have some cognitions that are completely invalid. Like attachment is an invalid cognition because what it's seeing is not existing there. The cake that attachment sees is not the cake on the plate. Ignorance is the deepest invalid cognition, misconception, because what it's seeing is an inherent delicious chocolate cake, an inherent me. So these are the words we have to try and understand as well. So Buddha's saying that the I that we think exists, the words he uses for it, we see it as an intrinsic I, an independent I, an inherent I, an I that exists from its own side, an I that exists truly, an I that exists in and of itself, a self-existent I. There are a dozen, easily more, synonyms for the phenomenon that we think is there, grasped at by ignorance, but which isn't there. That's what we've got to get used to thinking. And all the delusions are like that. Attachment believes in a phenomenon. When attachment, I've got my attachment glasses on, and it's a branch delusion, the cake I see through the lenses of attachment isn't the cake that exists there. So when And then ignorance, the deeper delusion that underpins the attachment. So the attachment causes the cake to look more delicious than it really is. The ignorance underpinning the attachment causes the delicious cake to appear. It's like the very ontological status of the cake itself. It appears intrinsically on the plate, independent, finally, of my mind cognizing it. So this gets us to the subtlest level of dependent arising. The first level is that, back to the I, there is no I that isn't, that isn't the product of causes. There is no I separate from the parts. And finally, there is no I separate from the mind cognizing it, merely labeled. As long as Opie says, when we've realized the emptiness of the inherent existence of the I, he says, it's as if there's no I. That's ultimate. But conventionally, he says, there is an I, a dependent arising I, a merely labeled I. But what does exist is so subtle, it's if it doesn't exist. And this sounds kind of tricky, you know. The I appears, when you realize emptiness, it's as if there's no I. And then you realize dependent arising, there is an I, but what does exist is so subtle, it's as if it's no I. I mean, this sounds like a yogi tricky talk, but it's exactly the way yogis see it. So we've got to try and find where these two are not contradictory. This is the major point. And we can even understand intellectually that every time we think about dependent arising, that there is an I that does exist independent upon causes, parts, and the mind labeling it, that tells us that there is no intrinsic I. And every time you think about the emptiness of the intrinsic I, that tells you there is a dependent arising I. And these get ever more subtle, until eventually, as I said, these come together. They're just flip sides of the same coin. When we're really on the right track, when we can start to hear them not as contradictory, and that just takes a bit of just thinking and analysis. And like anything, this stuff is not mysterious. Don't mystify it. I mean, someone who's been thinking, they says, oh, I've been thinking about emptiness for 40 years, I still don't understand it. And I'll say to them, well, what's the definition? And they say, oh, I don't know. Well, if you don't even know how to define what emptiness is, if you don't even know the intellectual words, of course you'll never understand it because you've got to think about it. It's like saying, oh, I've been thinking about 1 + 1 = 2 for 40 years and I don't understand it. It means you haven't analyzed one, you haven't analyzed plus, you haven't analyzed equals, and you haven't analyzed two. So you can't put the concepts together. Of course you'll never understand it. It won't come to you like a revelation. Oh, suddenly two is the answer. You've got to squeeze your brain. Same here. So learn the definitions. Learn the use of the words. I mean, as soon as I hear people talking about computers, I'm lost. I have no idea what they're talking about because I haven't learned the terms. So, but it doesn't mean I can't learn them. But we think emptiness is intrinsically difficult. I mean, frankly, I think bodhicitta is much more difficult than emptiness. I'd rather talk about emptiness any day. Bodhicitta sounds insane. So don't mystify it. And then the more you learn the words, the penny drops bit by bit, you know. So let's look at something else. Let's just look again a bit more, another approach about how you can't have dependent arising without emptiness, and you can't have emptiness without dependent arising, because they are the flip sides of the same coin. It's two different ways, effectively, of saying the same thing. So in other words, emptiness is that the I lacks an independent character. So the dependent arising way of putting it is the I possesses an interdependent character. It's the same way of saying it. Lacking an independent character is another way of saying having an interdependent character. It's exactly the same. I mean, they're not technically the same, but it's like the same. Don't think they're not. Just got to use the right words, you know. And Lord Buddha tells us in the Heart Sutra, righteous. He says, form. Okay, what's Buddha on about? He's telling you what Buddha's doing. He's sitting in Rajagriha, he's in meditation, but the people doing the talking are his disciples. Avalokitesvara, as a trans-level bodhisattva, as a human, and Shariputra, they're having a chat. Buddha's facing out in meditation, but he's channeling his thoughts into their mouths. So they're having the talk. They're talking. So, well, basically it's Shariputra mostly. Now, he asks Avalokiteshvara the question, then Shariputra answers, and the rest of the Heart Sutra is Shariputra's answer. So what he's doing is he's breaking, what he's saying is, you know, he's describing all the different components of the universe, the five aggregates, the four noble truths, the 12 links of dependent arising, this one, that one, this one, that one. They all are empty of existing from their own side. He's telling us that. At some points, he mentions the first of the five aggregates. The aggregates is just a way that Buddha presents a person in terms of possessing five different components. And the first one is called form, which is essentially referring to our physicality. And this can be used, you can say any word there instead of form. Doesn't matter. So we'll start the way he said it. So what he says is this, form is emptiness. Form is empty, he says. Then he says, emptiness is form. Then he says, form is nothing other than emptiness. And emptiness is nothing other than form. Well, what he's saying is this. There's Donna and her mistake seeing, well, let's say the cancer one, okay? So, now let's keep it, okay, let me think of an example. Okay, yeah. So no, just think of something simple. Think of something, my thermos is black. So we know thermos is one thing and black is a color. We know that. So you could say wherever there is thermos, in this case, there is black. And wherever there is black, there is thermos. So thermos is nothing other than black and black is nothing other than thermos. That makes sense. So you can't have black without a thermos. In this case, you can't say there's black and there's a thermos. That's schizophrenic. Black is a characteristic of a thermos. Well, for Donna, black thermos is empty of pink. And wherever Donna sees black thermos, she will see the emptiness of pink when she's realized it. And wherever you find the emptiness of pink, you'll find that nowhere but right there on the black thermos. So black thermos is empty of pink. Emptiness of pink is black thermos. Wherever there's black thermos, there is emptiness of pink. And wherever there's emptiness of pink, there's black thermos. We get that. Same here. Form is empty. Donna's empty. And emptiness of Donna is emptiness. Okay, Donna, interdependent Donna is, oh, my battery's running out. I've got to plug in. Hang on. Where do I plug in? Here, my computer. This is the wrong hole. Oh dear, what am I doing? Here it is. I don't know what it is about this North Carolina group. It works perfectly for the whole world for the last year, but just my computer for North Carolina. It doesn't make sense, does it? You've got to admit, it doesn't make any sense at all, and I can't solve it. Even my John Castle, my IT genius, can't solve it either, but I haven't asked him. I better check. He did check me last week. Where's the hole? Here we go. Hang on. Now I'm upside down. I'm looking at the sky now. Look at me. This is ridiculous. I have to go back. Yeah. Got to put it on the edge. Oh, it's so difficult. Now I'm sitting in front. I've got to hold it. I can't do anything else. Okay, I'll just have to hold it. Is it plugged in yet? No, it's not plugged in yet. What's happening? No. There we go. Okay, I have to hold it. So, instead of thinking emptiness is one thing, no, instead of thinking that when we say emptiness, it negates existence. That's the mistake. But emptiness not only doesn't, I want you to see the Buddha as well, emptiness not only doesn't negate existence, this is the point now, emptiness not only doesn't negate, where are you? I can't get this right. I'm so sorry, people. I keep looking at the sky. It's no good. I've got to do it this way. So emptiness not only doesn't negate the emptiness of inherent Donna, not only doesn't negate the existence of Donna, it proves the existence of Donna. That's what we've got to get used to. For us, emptiness, we go, oh, well, Donna's empty anyway, so it doesn't matter. That's nihilism. That's the instinctive response we have. This is why we need to understand emptiness in the context of dependent arising. That's why dependent arising is the king of logics. We've got to get used to the idea that when you say empty, it is implying existence. In fact, things can't exist if they're not empty of intrinsic existence. We've got to get used to that. Emptiness reinforces existence. Things exist because they are empty. In other words, Buddha is telling us that something that has an intrinsic nature, which is what we believe utterly, profoundly, and completely and totally, something that has an intrinsic nature cannot possibly exist. That's where Buddha diverged from the Hindus. They were amazing. They went so far. They were geniuses in understanding the universe, giving up attachment, giving up delusions, but they still posit something intrinsic, an Atman, a creator. This is where he argues with the Christians. He just says it's not viable. It's not possible. And we can't just believe that. We have to study it. And then why should we study all this stuff? Why do we want to squeeze our brain? Because realizing this is what cuts all suffering completely. That's the point about emptiness. What do you think, people? Any questions? Any doubts? Or just any one thing you want to say? Don't have to be clever. I mean, I can know a few words, okay? I can't know much. But just discuss with me if you want to. So again, I want to say the real point of realizing emptiness is just to be some clever person who gets full marks in your philosophy exam. Not like that. The real reason to realize emptiness is so you realize your own true nature. You become blissful, radiant, connected, not separate from others, full of love, full of wisdom, full of compassion. Fear has gone. We did that story last week about Lama Zopa. Fear. Didn't we tell the story of Lama Zopa last week? Yeah, we did. So when you realize emptiness, there is no fear. Meaning, and this is the thing that's fascinating, all the delusions, attachment, anger, pride, jealousy, the lot, as well as root delusion, they're all rooted in fear. Fear is their flavor. That's why we suffer in daily life all the time. Our constant worries and anxiety and this and that, they're rooted in fear, and because we believe everything is intrinsic. Of course it's hard to see this. Of course it's hard to see that we suffer because we think some things are intrinsic. It sounds like hilarious. But by thinking about it, gradually practicing, first abiding by karma, then seeing the mind, practicing, purifying, slowly the penny drops. You know, we start to, all the bits and pieces of the whole map come together. I don't know, people, what else? That'll do, maybe it's time to go to bed. What time is it? 5 minutes, come on. Time to go, time to finish. No other questions there, Donna,
Lorna's hand just went up.
Oh, Lorna, good sweetheart, talk to me.
So is karma dependent arising?
Yeah, that's my exact point. It's an example of cause and effect,
right,
which is the first level of dependent arising. Arguing with one of the prevailing views at the time that there is an I, this is what the Hindus think, or some of the Hindus, there is an I of the soul for that matter, but it's permanent and has no cause. It's a gift from God sort of thing. That's the argument against that. So that's why karma is so powerful as a way to loosen the grip of poor self-pity me. Do you understand?
Yeah. Yes.
That's exactly right, Lorna. Exactly, darling. So, it's the strong one, like, you know, that T.E.'s point, not T.E., yeah, maybe T.E., was it T.E.'s point or somebody else's point? Yeah, T.E.'s point about how maybe the mind is the I. It's a really interesting point because all the other schools of thought, and there's so many of them before you get Prasangika Majjhimika, they all say there has to be something that you can put the name I on. Otherwise, it's nihilism. And that's why this Prasangika Majjhimika view is so hard to hear, because the way Lama Zopa says it is so radical. He says, when you understand it, he says from the side of the I or the thermos or whatever, there's not an atom of anything there that makes it I, that makes it thermos. And that feels like, oh my God, we're jumping off the cliff, there's nothing there. But he's not saying that. This is why dependent arising and emptiness are so powerful, that we know them together, because they kind of anchor us. And I found another interesting comment. It's just my own observation. You think about this. If we're caught up in this ego grasping, that's the colloquial term for this ignorance, which is the root delusion that informs attachment and anger and all the others, they're all the branch delusions of this one. If, you know, the feeling then we are living in this constant up and down. You know how we're sort of living an up and down all the time, up and down like a yo-yo. When attachment gets what it wants, that's what we call happiness. We get all overexcited. Now I found happiness. Finally, I found the best job. Finally, my body is the right weight. Finally, I found the right boyfriend. Now we've got happiness, and you're already projecting the next 57 years of your life. It's perfect. You know? That's the mode that in the mistaken view of everything has an intrinsic nature, that we think it's set in stone. Now I've got happiness. And then your mind goes berserk, and you go, and then what happens? The bubble will burst, and then you go crashing down where to despair, which is the nihilistic view. There's nothing. There's nothing worthwhile. I might as well kill myself. It's almost like we're all bipolar. It's a question of degree. And I'm not being sarcastic here. We're up and down like yo-yos. We're so unstable emotionally, and that's because of attachment, getting overexcited, and you set it in stone. I always, you know, and this is worth impermanence as well. I always quote when I read, I remember reading an interview with Nicole Kidman when she was with Tom Cruise, like 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and I love the woman. I'm not trying to criticize her, but it was so crystal clear the way she said it. She said, you know, obviously their life was wonderful. They were in love. They had children. The whole family was perfect. Think of our own lives. This is how we are. Your life is lovely. You've got a house. You've got the hubby. You've got the kids. You wake up every morning. It's all still there. So naturally, you're going to grasp that it's permanent. Naturally, you're going to think it's going to last forever. This is one of the major sufferings before we get anywhere near emptiness, that we assume because it's here today, it must be there tomorrow. This is really when we start to loosen the grip of this view. This really helps us get closer to emptiness. So she said, Nicole said, I remember in this interview, we will be together until we are 80, she said. Analyze this. This is attachment talking, but it's hand in hand with the other mistake that because you are so happy with Tom and the kids and the life, and that means your attachment's getting what it wants. You're so happy that then you put this extra lie on top and say it'll last forever. Because frankly, we can't bear the thought that it won't last forever. That's why attachment is such a junkie. We have to then assume it's going to last forever. That's the mistake of a permanence. And this, because of this mistake of attachment. And then all of this leads to seeing it as self-existent. All these mistakes are linked very intimately, but we've got to understand each of their functions, you know. We will be together until we are 80. That's what we all feel, because we're desperate for the happiness to come. We get the happiness. You get the boyfriend. You get the job. Now I found happiness. It's like we take it and we put it and we lock the key and now it's permanent. That's the mistake the mind makes automatically. And so then, of course, when the bubble burst and I always joke and Penelope Cruz came along and took him, whatever happened, I'm just joking. I read the newspapers. I always read the gossip pages. When our magazines were in vogue, now I have my iPad. I used to always read People, you know. I don't get People anymore. Anyway, whatever. So then, you know, so suddenly what happened? Her expectation was shattered. The bubble burst and she crashed down to despair. And then she was in fetal position. I read other stories. And her mother would kick her and say, get up and get on with life, you know. So that we all know this. This is how we are every day. We've got these bipolar episodes 1,000 times a day. You've got all, see, this is a function of attachment. One of the functions of attachment is expectation. It's a hunger to get the good thing. And when you get it, you can't believe, it's like you won the lottery. You can't believe it. So naturally you want it to last forever. You can't bear the thought that it's a fleeting thing. We can't bear that thought. And underneath all of this, these mistakes with permanence and attachment are driven by ego grasping, are driven by the root delusion that thinks it's all set in stone and inherent. It's the subtlest mistake, you know. It's the subtlest mistake, the hardest one to see. So we keep working, keep studying, keep practicing, keep analyzing, keep squeezing our brain, keep meditating. That's it. And slowly, slowly, you know. Okay, Donna. Done.
Okay.
Thank you, darling people. So kind. And I'm sorry I can't see you all. What to do? Maybe next week my computer will work. It's a total mystery. I've got to get John onto the case again. It's a complete mystery. Everyone else that works on the planet, just for you guys. And the iPad works, for God's sake. So who knows what it is. Okay, so we shall have a little dedication prayer. Here we've been for 2 whole hours, me raving on like a maniac. Let's hope there's something that's been useful. Something, you know, thoughts in the mind and maybe said, wow, that's a good point. I get that one. A little insights you've had. Nourish them. Delight in them. Be glad. And these seeds we planted, how amazing. And none of these 2 hours will go astray. We might remember not most of it, but all the seeds stay there. So we're going to nourish these seeds with our effort from this moment forward. So the seeds do grow as we motivated in the development of our Buddhahood. So we really can be a benefit to others. How amazing. Never give up, okay? So to say in English. So do, I'm going to put in my words onto it. So due to these virtuous karmic seeds that we have planted this last 2 hours, may I quickly, just as we motivated, may I quickly achieve the state of a Guru Buddha. And then I'll be able to, exactly as we motivated, be able to lead all beings to the wisdom that I have found based on my compassion, so they can become enlightened as well. And the second one is marvelous of aspiration. There's amazing bodhicitta, which we haven't talked about, but that's the other wing of the bird. This wisdom on its own, by the way, a bird needs two wings. You can't have bodhicitta without. You can have bodhicitta. You can even lose bodhicitta, people. You can't lose emptiness. But bodhicitta is not enough. Emptiness is not enough. You've got to have two wings, okay? So may this marvelous, amazing aspiration, this brave attitude of the bodhisattvas to never give up wanting to benefit others, may it continue to grow and grow in the minds of all sentient beings. That's it, Donna. Thank you, darling. So much. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you, Sita.
See you next week. We'll summarize the whole thing again, and we'll go into more about emptiness and dependent arising. Maybe have your questions, okay?
Great.
Thank you, darling.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Venerable Urbina.
Thank you, Venerable Urbina.
Thank you, Donna.
Thank you, Donna.
Thank you, Donna.
Thanks, everyone.